Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Get ready for the big game with big savings at your local grocery outlet. This week, Thomas Farms 93% lean grass-fed ground beef is just $4.99 a pound. That's a savings of up to 52% versus traditional grocery stores. Also, save up to 50% on 30-ounce bags of Blue Diamond almonds. Assorted varieties are just $9.99. Rush in and score big at your neighborhood grocery outlet. Offers good through February 14th.
Grocery Outlet Bargain Market.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Myerson, and before you get to your chosen podcast, I want to ask you one question. How did an insignificant army corporal end up as Chancellor of all Germany? It's a story that's improbable and also a lesson for us all. My new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels it in 16 dramatised episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Toby Stevens, Alexander Vlahos and Laura Donnelly. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 10th of February. The Turkish president admits the earthquake rescue effort is too slow, while relief workers in rebel-held areas of Syria accuse the UN of not acting impartially. We report from the shelled border town in Russia backing Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. And China tries to encourage couples to have more babies. Also in the podcast, the Dutch city of Amsterdam is cracking down on drugs tourists.
They want to attract more of what the mayor has controversially referred to as the right kind of tourists, talking about people who will visit the museums and art galleries instead.
And why some are calling for a boycott of the new Harry Potter video game. The earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria in the early hours of Monday morning is now officially the sixth most deadly this century, with more than 22,000 people officially confirmed dead. And yet, more than 100 hours after the quake hit, people are still being pulled alive from the rubble, including a 10-day-old baby. But for many more families, it is a tale of despair, as Quentin Somerville reports from the southern Turkish city of Antakya.
So, day five of the rescue operation. We just have a look up in this building. We've been following these rescue workers since last night. They're mostly volunteers. They've barely had any sleep. One of them told me he's had 3 hours in the last 5 days. They think they've held someone inside. I was just up there. We couldn't see anyone. We're now digging under the rubble to try and retrieve someone, but what there is up there is an overpowering smell of dead bodies. In the first, second and third day of the rescue mission, they were finding a lot of people. This lot pulled out maybe a couple of dozen, including very young children from buildings all along here. They say these buildings, and if you look at these buildings, they've collapsed on their side, and then you have these buildings which have flattened completely. These are the most dangerous buildings, they say, the ones that are still teetering, but the ones that have collapsed completely, pancaked, they're going right inside, they're going deep inside, they're making tunnels to try and get people out. But the reality is, and this will be very difficult news for families here, is that many of the rescue workers believe that this is no longer a case of rescuing survivors. We're now moving into a phase where we're recovering bodies.
Quentin Somerville in Antakya. The Turkish government has been criticised for its slow response to the quake, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has responded. On a visit to Adıyaman province, he admitted that the rescue effort wasn't going as quickly as he hoped. He also said the official death toll in Turkey had risen to just under 19,000. The BBC's Emre Temel in Istanbul listened to President Erdogan's speech.
He admits that on the first day, the relief efforts were a bit slow, but Mr. Erdogan says from the second day on, everything was on track and the state was its people with all of its institutions. As you said, he announced a new death toll, which is almost 19,000. More than 74,000 people have been injured. More than 75,000 people have been rescued. And more than 76,000 people have been evacuated. President Erdogan is visiting Adıyaman, one of the quake hit provinces in southern Turkey. And he said the emergency rule you mentioned aimed to combat exploitation, instigators, and the incidents of looting. He also pledged to rebuild the quake hit region as part of a one-year plan and add some financial incentives. However, these earthquakes hit 10 provinces in Turkey where more than 30 million people live. And we are talking about an area spanning more than 1,000 square kilometers. That's why the plan President announced seems to be an Herculean task.
Emre Temel of the BBC Turkish service. On the Syrian side of the border, more than 3,300 people have died in the quake. The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, has been to the city of Aleppo, ravaged by years of civil war and now hit by the earthquake. Aid convoys are only just arriving in Syria, and the White Helmets organization, which works in rebel-held areas of Syria, has criticized the UN for its response to the earthquake. Ubadar Alwan spoke to us from Istanbul.
It's been 5 days after the earthquake, and there's been no aid in terms of response to the earthquake. The aid that has come into Syria is part of the regular aid convoys that came in even before the earthquake, as northwest Syria heavily relies on aid from the UN. The challenges and difficulties come from the cross-border resolution from the Security Council as well. You know, there's security and protocol about bringing aid in. And there's people, there's volunteers, there's organizations that want to get into Syria, but it's just been very difficult at the moment. It's disrupted that ability to kind of help.
Well, the UN has called for more border crossings to be opened from Turkey into northern Syria. I got more details about the criticism of the UN's response from our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folks.
We had a briefing ourselves here in Geneva from the head of the White Helmets, whose frustration could absolutely not be disguised. He said that really the support, humanitarian support from the United Nations just wasn't there. And when pushed on that, I said to him, you know, there are these hindrances. Russia, the Security Council, for example, opposing more border crossings from Turkey into Syria. He accused the UN of just being frightened of Russia, not wanting to do anything to offend permanent members of the Security Council. What I would say is I've just also been hearing the UN aid agency's brief, and they share the frustration, perhaps a different perspective, but they have been desperate, not just since the earthquake struck, but for months to have more border crossings open from Turkey into Syria, because 4.1 million people are reliant on humanitarian aid there. That was before this earthquake. It's the middle of winter. And getting the aid from Damascus requires the Syrian regime's approval. In the last 12 months, 10 convoys got through, but that's not nearly enough. The World Food Programme made that very clear this morning. It has to be much, much more.
And has the UN responded directly to those criticisms from the White Helmets, or are they just talking about the operation more generally?
We're talking here, this is Geneva, about the humanitarian arm of the UN. They are often privately very frustrated at the politics that happens over at the Security Council in New York. They do not want to criticise anyone directly. What we have heard over and over again is, please let us not politicise this terrible crisis. People are in need in Turkey, in government-controlled areas of Syria, in opposition-controlled areas of Syria. They are equally in need, all human beings. The aid agencies want to get to them all, and they don't want politics to get in the way. But unfortunately, as we are seeing now, politics do seem to be getting in the way.
Imogen Folks, who covers the UN in Geneva for us. When Russia invaded Ukraine nearly a year ago, one of the justifications from President Putin was the need to protect Russians from what he claimed was a threat to their security. In reality, the so-called special military operation in Ukraine has left many in Russia feeling less rather than more secure. Military bases deep inside Russia have been hit by drone attacks, while regions close to the Ukrainian border face regular shelling. One such area is Belgorod, and our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has been to visit.
Near Russia's border with Ukraine, the goods trains create an air of normality. In reality, normality ended when Russia invaded Ukraine. I'm about to see that. At a market close by, there aren't many customers, but there's lots of repair work going on after a mortar attack. Sandbags have been stacked around shops here. And in the distance, intermittent explosions. Everyone I speak to here tells me they live in fear of Ukrainian shelling, but they omit to mention it was their country that invaded Ukraine.
A год назад. Ну, спокойно было,
может. Тихо было, ничего такого не было.
And like Раиса, the chocolate seller, there's something else they all say. That before the invasion, life here was peaceful. And yet no one seems to join the dots to conclude that it's Vladimir Putin's war that has put them in danger. They blame Kyiv. The minds of Ukrainians have been altered, Raisa says. A new generation has grown up there, hating Russians. We need to re-educate them, remake them. In recent months, there have been explosions too in the city of Belgorod, a few miles away, including at the airport and an apparent strike on a power station. Again, people here are focusing on external enemies. In a Belgorod knitting shop, the owner gives me the needle. We hear bad things about the BBC, he says. We're told you talk rubbish. Then he accuses the West of trying to annihilate Russia like Hitler. And when I assure him he's wrong... Oh, yeah. Pull the other one. Outside the shop, law student Ksenia is equally critical. Ukraine is a Western puppet, she says, and the West has always wanted to destroy Russia. Hitler wanted to grab our land. Who doesn't?
Hitler тоже так думал.
Listen to Olga. She runs a church choir in Belgorod. Russia didn't attack Ukraine, Olga tells me. Russians are peace-loving and generous. A Russian will give you the shirt off his back. He will never attack you. He will protect you.
Он никогда просто так не нападет. Он пойдет только защищать.
Along a busy road in Belgorod stands a giant letter Z, the symbol of the special military operation. In Z Russia, invasion is liberation and war is peace.
That report by our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. Over the past few days, the Ukrainian president has been on a tour of Europe, calling on his allies to supply warplanes. But today, Volodymyr Zelensky is making a different kind of request. He's addressing a virtual meeting of 30 countries to press his demand that Russia and Belarus be banned from next year's Summer Olympics in Paris. Nick Robinson has been talking to our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
No one's suggesting that Russia and Belarus, in fact, will be present at the Paris Olympics next year officially, that their anthems or national flags will be shown. The International Olympic Committee called on sports to exclude both countries from international sports events last year following the invasion of Ukraine. That cast them into the sporting wilderness. They became sporting pariahs, effectively. But the IOC is now exploring a pathway for their readmission at the Paris 24 Olympics, for which qualification events have already begun. So a decision will need to be made quite soon, but strictly under a neutral flag. So athletes would have to wear, for example, I understand, all white kit. There'd be no flags flown, no national anthems. It would be very strict. It would be, the IOC say, discriminatory to continue to ban them based on their citizenship. That's the direction of travel. But there are fears that Russia's Vladimir Putin could gain a political advantage from the inclusion of his country. And several nations, including the UK, have condemned this plan. Ukraine, in fact, has threatened to refuse to take part. Poland has even claimed that several dozen nations, as many as 40 perhaps, could join Ukraine in boycotting the Games if the IOC presses ahead. So this is a very divisive issue. It's a very thorny issue, and it will be discussed at length at this summit today, which the UK hosts.
And those with very long memories will remember the Moscow Olympics back in 1980, the political controversy that was dragged into.
Absolutely, yes. And then, of course, the repercussion of that was that there was a reaction from the Soviet Union 4 years later and a subsequent boycott in 1984 as well of the LA Games. And the point that the IOC president, Thomas Bach, has made is that such moves don't work politically. They only mean that the athletes suffer. I think what you will have as a result of today's meeting is a collective statement. I think this is the hope of the UK anyway, that continues to make the case against such a move. But it's important to add that in sports like tennis, the Australian Open, for example, recently, Russian and Belarusian athletes have been allowed to compete, albeit under neutral flags.
Our sports editor, Dan Rowan. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
If they can finally get this machine working, it will absolutely revolutionise how people get things into orbit.
Testing the most powerful rocket in history. A demographic crisis is what some experts say China is facing after its population fell last year for the first time since 1961. After decades of trying to get the birth rate down through its punitive one-child policy, the communist government is now actively encouraging people to have bigger families. But amid rising costs of modern living, some couples are not keen. Today, a senior health official, Yang Wanzhuang, called for more action to help boost the population, as I heard from our Asia business correspondent, Katie Silver.
He's basically telling local governments to take bold steps, trying to encourage them, to encourage people to have more babies. It was a state-backed magazine, and it was the head of the Population Monitoring and Family Development part of the government's health board, basically urging local governments to explore how they can help, what policies they can enact to reduce the cost of childbirth, childcare and education. Now, the publication said that China has what they quote, an important window period of population development. And that is now up until the 2025, so the 14th of these five-year terms. They say this is a crucial time and that they need to try and combat concerns that many women, for example, have when it comes to money and career development, which prevent them from having babies.
Yeah, because the one-child policy stopped in 2015, but the birth rate obviously hasn't gone up since then enough.
Yes. So what this shows is just once a policy is in place, how hard it is to turn it around. So as you say, the one-child policy ended in 2015. We saw the start then of the two-child policy. That was ended and then people were allowed three children. And then that was done away with altogether and to try and encourage people to have more children. But what it is you've got this precedent where people expect to spend a great deal of money on their children. There's a huge pressure. You know, the online tutoring industry there has been huge. And people also grew up with not having siblings. So this idea of having siblings isn't necessarily within the culture, and it shows how hard it is to shift this. We're seeing some local governments there try some pretty new or innovative things, particularly in the past month, for example. In one region, they're giving money to sperm donors to try and increase the amount of sperm within the sperm bank so people can have, be able to have more children through that. They're also giving unmarried couples who have children the same benefits as married couples. So they are trying to enact policy changes. But as I say, it's very, very hard to change it once the ball is already in motion.
And remind us of why it is such a problem to have a falling population, because, of course, for many years, the fear was overpopulation in China.
If you have a falling population, what that means is that the amount of workers you would have, the labour force, isn't enough to sustain your growing elderly population. So your labour force, and particularly when it comes to China, if you think of the factories, to make the goods that are going to be able to fund the elderly population, there just aren't going to be the workers. And the problem there for the rest of the world is the fact that China being the factory of the world means that we're not going to have those workers in order to staff those factories in order to make the goods that the global economy needs. So that's one of the pressures as well.
BBC Asia business correspondent Katie Silver. The South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, came into office 5 years ago promising a new dawn after Jacob Zuma's controversial time in office. But with record electricity outages wreaking havoc on the economy, Mr. Ramaphosa's reputation has taken a battering. So his State of the Nation address to Parliament was always going to be tough. And even before he spoke, there were chaotic scenes, as Nomsa Maseko reports from Cape Town.
There was pomp and ceremony at first, which was then followed by chaos and drama at the start of President Cyril Ramaphosa's speech.
Security services, you may intervene.
Proceedings were delayed after opposition MPs from the Economic Freedom Fighters took disrupting parliamentary seatings to new heights when they stormed the podium on which President Ramaphosa was to deliver his State of the Nation speech. The MPs were eventually ejected from the chamber. Economic Freedom Fighters President Julius Malema claimed his party was attacked for staging a peaceful protest.
When we are inside there, and when I went on the stage with a placard, it is because Parliament is the highest stage of protest. No one can deny that Parliament is a stage and formalized stage of protest. And if protest cannot be tolerated in Parliament, where else is it going to be tolerated? They have set a precedent that anyone who exercises his right is going to be violated by police. When I went on the stage, I was not singing, I was not disruptive, I was holding my placard peacefully, quietly.
After delays of more than half an hour, President Ramaphosa outlined solutions to a host of issues, including the rolling electricity blackouts, which are crippling the economy and have resulted in further job losses.
The National Disaster Management Center has consequently classified the energy crisis and its impact as a disaster. We are therefore declaring a national state of disaster to respond to the electricity crisis and its effect.
State electricity utility Eskom has been implementing the worst rolling blackout on record, disrupting manufacturing and forcing small businesses to shut down. So, declaring a national state of disaster will enable the government to speed up energy projects and limit the red tape in procurement procedures. To address the rising cost of living, President Cyril Ramaphosa extended the relief funding, which is earned by more than 8 million unemployed South Africans. Matthew Parks speaks for the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
We can't afford as a nation to leave behind a quarter of our country with no source of income. That's national suicide. It's not a perfect amount. We do need to increase it to the food poverty line itself, which is not a perfect amount too. But it's better than nothing. It helps people to go forward. We are cognizant of the fiscal constraints facing the state. It's not a long-term solution. We need to get people working. But in the medium term, we need to make sure that people are not left behind. As you find ways to grow the economy, you find ways through skills programs, through employment programs, to get people into the labour market. But in the meantime, we have to do it, and always to have a social net, as other progressive countries would do, for those who are not able to find work.
While the speech was welcomed by the majority of opposition parties, it remains to be seen if the proposed plans will be implemented effectively.
Nomsa Maseko reporting from South Africa. Millions of visitors flock to Amsterdam every year, some attracted by its cannabis cafes. But now the Dutch authorities have announced that smoking marijuana in public will be banned in the city's red light district from mid-May after complaints from residents. I heard more from our correspondent in the Netherlands, Anna Holligan.
This is part of the council's long-running campaign to try to revamp Amsterdam's raunchy reputation. They've been talking for such a long time about banning tourists altogether from the cannabis cafes. This is kind of one step back from that and saying that people aren't allowed to smoke cannabis in public from May. They're also launching a campaign designed to keep drug tourists out of the city. They want to attract more of what the mayor, Femke Halsema, has kind of controversially referred to as the right kind of tourists, talking about people who will visit the museums and art galleries instead. But I have been in so many cannabis cafes, and most recently I spoke to one owner who said, well, actually a lot of our visitors are people who also visit the museums and galleries. salaries, and you can't really discriminate in that way. But I've also spoken to people sitting alongside the canals in their beautiful canalside homes who say in the summer they can't breathe because there are so many tourists walking around smoking joints.
Yeah, I mean, is there any evidence about whether this will reduce numbers of tourists coming to Amsterdam?
The big fear is what it will do is not necessarily reduce the numbers of tourists coming in, but increase the number of illegal and unregulated street dealers who will prey upon those who have come for the drugs anyway. And one of the other arguments from the cannabis cafes is, well, actually, most of the nuisance is caused by drunken tourists. And in fact, the council has announced new measures to try to counter the alcohol problem. So bars, restaurants will have to close by 2 a.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. No new visitors after 1 a.m. inside this area because, you know, the red light district, famous for the red light windows, famous for the cannabis cafes, but it's also a residential area. And with the numbers of people coming in on cheap flights, they had to do something because this is coming to breaking point for so many of the people who actually try to live there.
Anna Holligan. Next to the US-Mexico border. And that is the sound of the most powerful rocket ever created. The super heavy booster for the Starship craft was tested by Elon Musk's SpaceX company on Thursday night. It was held in place on a launch pad taller than the Statue of Liberty as it produced more than 700 tons of thrust. Watching was Dr. Ezzie Pearson from the BBC's Sky at Night magazine.
This is the rocket that SpaceX are hoping in the next couple of weeks to launch what's called their spaceship. So they tested the engines, basically. They had what's called a static fire test. So this is where you fuel up the rocket, you fire all of the engines, but it's clamped so it can't go anywhere. This is going to be a new launch vehicle that can put up to 100 tons in one go into low Earth orbit. And if they can finally get this machine working, it will absolutely revolutionize how people get things into orbit. Not just the sheer scale of what it can carry, but the fact that it is going to be completely reusable. So not just the vehicle itself, but also that launch rocket. And that means it's going to reduce the cost of putting things into orbit. Getting to Mars is Elon Musk's big dream. So what Spaceship will be able to do is put things into low Earth orbit, possibly up to 100 people at a time. And being able to do that much means that you can construct something that will be able to take you to Mars much, much more easily. If you could send people to Mars, people can do a lot more scientific research than a robot can. What all of the Mars robots have done together, a human could probably do in one day. We're much more efficient and we're much more able to look around. So the sort of amount of scientific exploration that a person can do, even on a short mission, would be invaluable. There's also the long-term goal of maybe one day moving people more long-term to Mars. That's possibly a pipe dream, but the only way we're going to find out if it's possible is if people start trying.
Ezzie Pearson from Sky at Night magazine. Now, it's one of the most anticipated games of the year. Hogwarts Legacy, a big-budget video game set in the Harry Potter universe, is released today. But some critics are calling for a boycott because of comments about transgender rights from the Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling. This report from our gaming correspondent Stefan Powell.
It's perhaps surprising, given the level of interest in this world of wizards, witches and wands over the years, that a fully-fledged, big-budget gaming adaptation has taken this long to be made. Interest is high. Records have been broken in the lead-up to release, with 1.3 million people at one point watching early previews being played online. However, transgender rights advocates are urging people not to buy it, saying that doing so shows support for J.K. Rowling's public statements about the trans community. They say those views are transphobic, and supporting the game legitimises them by amplifying her voice and making her money. The author has previously said that she supports trans rights, but she doesn't believe transgender people should have access to single-sex spaces. The title has received positive reviews for its gameplay and is expected to be one of the biggest sellers of 2023.
Gaming correspondent Stefan Powell. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly-Forster and produced by Nikki Verrico. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Myerson, and before you get to your chosen podcast, I want to ask you one question. How did an insignificant army corporal end up as Chancellor of all Germany? It's a story that's improbable and also a lesson for us all. My new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels it in 16 dramatised episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Toby Stevens, Alexander Vlahos, and Laura Donnelly. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.